This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday. Matt and Patrick here today. Patrick, did I miss a memo? When did they decide to move? Is it COVID-related? They moved the NCAA tournament from the Thursday to it's a Friday through Monday now thing?
Yeah, that's after. They're doing all first four games tonight instead of usually they have two on Tuesday that feeds into the Thursday-Saturday side of the bracket, and then the Wednesday ones that go into the Friday and Sunday field. But this year they're just doing all four today, and I'm guessing that means they're all going into the Friday-Sunday.
Well, yeah, the Friday-Sunday and the Sunday-Monday that I'm going to guess, which, okay, good luck getting anything done work-wise on that day. I imagine that's going to have more than a few people paying attention to that. Just a glorious day. Have you heard that it is getting harder to find a bike in this town? You've seen the stories about the houses, right?
Yeah, I've seen those.
The housing market right now, it reminds me of what it was like when we bought our house back in 2001, and it was a case where they had mislabeled the garage size, and so people weren't looking at it, and we went over like, oh, get a signature quick, and we did, and we ended up getting that house, which was really nice. We were very happy about that. The bikes, though, is kind of interesting. I guess people are just presuming that we're going to have another few months of basically limited interaction. Or you're like me. I was talking. I'm part of one of the committees at my church, and we were talking. And they asked us, "Had you been back to church yet?" And I said, "No, I'm not coming back to church for a while yet." And I said, because what had happened, and I've shared the story. When this first broke a year plus ago. Maybe about a year ago, even just right about a year ago, somewhere around that time, we went to church and the priest came on out and he's saying, you know, hey guys, you know, we need to socially distance, respect boundaries, you know, try not to get too close. We don't, and at that point, we didn't know a lot about coronavirus. We were learning on the go. And we get to the point where we're doing the prayer and all of a sudden, here is this elderly woman who has come all the way down the pew to grab my hand and hold hands. And she's looking at me like, isn't this great? And I'm like, no, what are you doing? No, this is, yeah. And you do have people who are just generally really eager to be like that, to kind of go on out there and you know, grab hold of someone's hand and shake hands and do all that stuff. You know, that's why I don't go. And the same thing goes for gyms. I'm not going to go to a gym, not only because I've heard some really ugly stories about how you go into some of these places and no one's wearing a face mask and none of the people who are getting minimum wage feel the need to go tell anyone to put a face mask on, apparently. So I'm just going to have to, and people, my God, they never wiped down the machines before. After they used them, you're expecting people to wipe machines down now? Come on. No, they're going to walk away like they usually do. I'm not going to go. So that might be why the bikes are hard to come by. Also, apparently, to get a bike repaired takes a while now. So it's great. I mean, I live in Hopkins. We have in Hopkins when they're not building a light rail line on six different bike trails that are major bike trails that go for miles that start in Hopkins because it was a big junction point. So they've converted all those rail lines to bike trails. It is magnificent. I can go all the way to Nokomis. I can go over the way to Lake Minnetonka. I can go all the way to downtown Minneapolis. I can go out to freaking Chaska. I can go all the way out there. And I mean, it's just magnificent. So it's easy to see why. And Minneapolis is known internationally as one of the best biking cities in the world. So not a surprise. It just, yeah, you can't, apparently it's hard to find bikes now. So there you go. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. 6205. I'm keeping track on Unicorn Riot here because they've been doing kind of the best job, I think, of the updates during the day as far as keeping up to date on the trial. They just seated another juror, so that would get up to 12. Juror 95 is being sworn in. This is about 6 minutes ago. The last juror available for questioning it today. I can't believe if you've got 12 jurors sat, because, okay, so we, yesterday, and we'll talk about this. We'll start off, I guess, with the Chauvin trial today. With what happened yesterday, where you had the judge called back the prospective jurors, the nine that had already been picked, two of them were released because the settlement from the city of Minneapolis was deemed to have tarnished their potential there. Two more were picked up yesterday. Now they've had two. Now it sounds like three more added. This gets them up to 12. Your jury is 14. If you've got 14 jurors, 12 jurors right now, and all you need is two more, I'm a little hard-pressed to understand why you would need to, A, necessarily shift this trial to a later date, or B, shift it out of the city of Minneapolis at this point. I'm going to read from the earlier story from the Star Tribune because I know that they're not updated as of yet because that third juror, I guess, got just added now. Two jurors added Thursday afternoon during the jury total to 11. Now it's 12. For the murder trial of fired Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, an increase that came a day after two were removed. Last week's announcements of the $27 million lawsuit between the city and the survivors of George Floyd not only required Hennepin County District Judge Peter Cahill to subject seven jurors to a second round of questioning, but the remaining candidates chosen for scrutinization are sure to be quizzed about whether they have heard about the record-breaking payout. Heading into Thursday's proceedings, nine jurors had been selected to determine whether Chauvin caused the death of George Floyd on May 25th. During an arrest in South Minneapolis, the 10th juror, a nurse who lives in Edina, assured the court she could judge the evidence fairly despite having seen portions of the viral video of Floyd's arrest and after hearing about the settlement. Attorneys for both sides focused strongly on her 27 years as nursing in light of the trial, likely touching on how police dealt with Floyd becoming unresponsive during his arrest and the connection of drug use to his death. The woman, who is white, said her personal training would affect how she would look at the evidence. We all use our life experiences to make judgments, which for her duties included resuscitating patients in urgent situations and dispensing opiates while on the job. The judge interacted and pointed out that she can't be an expert witness in the jury room, though, and she agreed that would be wrong. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher quizzed the nurse about the drug addiction. She said she had seen patients who were hooked on opiates and doesn't believe any particular segment of the population is more susceptible than another. It can be anybody, which it can. There's plenty of the opiate people, the people that developed opiates, just evil. And they knew it. They knew they were making legal heroin, and they didn't care. The day's second new juror is a grandmother and a retired marketing professional who volunteers helping children in need with their homework. She said she started watching the video of Floyd's arrest but stopped after 4 to 5 minutes because it wasn't something that I needed to see as I shut things off I see in the news. The woman, who is black, said she had not formed opinions about either Chauvin or Floyd and was firm in saying news of the settlement would not affect her commitment to be an objective juror. As with many jury candidates, the woman was asked about her impressions of Black Lives Matter. She responded, "I'm black and my life matters." She disclosed that she has a relative who is on the Minneapolis police force, but they have not spoken about this case, nor are any experiences in law enforcement. The woman didn't consider herself particularly close to the relative, yet added, "I am proud of my relative for standing up and being a police officer." That bugs me a little bit. Because, again, we know about it. Star Tribune knows about it, clearly. Judge knows about it. And I would make a pretty good bet, now that we know this, probably the police union knows about this, too. And is it that much of a stretch to believe the police union might actually track down who this juror's family member is? And is it too much of a stretch to say, you know, to think that the police union might suggest this guy go talk to his grandma or mom or relative or whatever the relationship is? I don't know. I will say that it's a little disheartening because right now, I mean, once again, I want to make sure, and we're going to get to some behavioral issues here we have to discuss about the Minneapolis police. But knowing this, I mean, just, okay, remember Pointergate. Do you remember how ballistic the police went to try to take out Mayor Hodges at that time by making up a fake story about how pointing was the newest gang sign and shopped it around trying to get someone to bite until they came across the idiot Jay Coles over at KSTP and he ran with it and it became a laughing stock. But they were committed to it. And remember Bob Kroll's letter to the union. He was basically insisting that the officers involved in George Floyd were in the right at what happened there. So I'm sorry. I mean, I think there is a potential. I'm not saying it definitively will happen, but I'm saying, I mean, I would say, is there a potential that the police will track down who exactly this relative is and say, maybe you need to go talk to your relative before they get sequestered? I don't think it's that's fantasy. I don't think that that's science fiction to wonder if that's going to happen. And so I'm a little concerned about that, if you want to know the truth. Granted, I mean, if that ever came to light, jury tampering 101, and you know, if she was on the jury, because remember, two of the jurors will be alternates. If she was on the jury, you know, she could be removed, and that might proceed through. But you know, you could end up having a mistrial with something like that. And I'm frankly, if it looks like Chauvin's going to lose here, I don't know what might be on the table. I mean, because they. Trust me, there's a lot of police in the Minneapolis Police Department right now that do not want him to be guilty. Even though that what you saw there, I mean, there was, outside of the Minneapolis Police Department, I didn't see one police department say, yeah, that was quality police work, what Derek Chauvin did to George Floyd. Didn't see one. Jury, anyway, so, I mean, like I said, I don't think it's science fiction to speculate, to wonder, to ask the question, would the police union try to get in touch if this is a relative of a police officer in the Minneapolis Police Department? I'm hoping Judge Cahill puts down some very specific rules that says, if that, you know, you say you're not close, so if that family member comes a knocking, do not answer the door, and before they get sequestered. But, I mean, like I said, I mean, that's just, it's pure speculation, but it's a concern. Damn right it's a concern. Opening statements are scheduled to begin on March 29th as a midday Thursday. Four more jurors were needed to hear the murder and manslaughter trial. So we're actually down to 12 now. So it's basically we're up to 12. So I think 14 is the jury. So they only need two more at this point. Jury selection proceeded without incident last week until last Friday when the Minneapolis leaders announced their settlement with the Floyd family. Thursday's jury selection began with a woman's quick dismissal by the judge, again in connection with the settlement. She said she's exposed to news coverage routinely in her home and heard about the settlement. Asked whether that development moved her closer to the prosecution side and against the defendant, the woman said, a little bit. That was enough for Cahill to call that one. She was followed by a mother. Yep, just a smidge. Well, then, so long. Thanks for coming on by. She was followed by a mother of five grown children who said she also viewed no video of Floyd's arrest and has seen just a single photo from his encounter with the police. She also said she had not heard about the settlement. The woman said she had a negative view of sometimes violent protesters and Floyd's death, pointing the physical damage to the city. It seems like there was more crime there than there was before. Well, that's because we had a whole bunch of white supremacists coming from outstate Minnesota and out of the state of Minnesota completely and caused a lot of chaos. So, yeah, you're kind of on point there. She added her son was among fellow protesters on the 35W bridge in downtown Minneapolis where the large truck rolled through the crowd. Very frightening when she called to tell me that. He told me that, saying that she didn't know he was out protesting but wasn't angry for him for doing so. Questioning about law enforcement, when the woman said it's fair for officers to be scrutinized for their on-duty action but also holds a high respect for the profession. She said it in writing before appearing that she felt neutral about Chauvin but someone negative towards Floyd because of his scrapes with the law. While the defense indicated receptively that her being on the jury, the prosecution used one of its discretionary strikes to excuse her. The next jury candidate, the court muted on live stream audio, and the subsequent discussion resulted in the judge dismissing the woman. Two news reporters were in the courtroom listening, but Cahill ordered them not to disclose what they heard. Cahill did explain that this is potential juror is acquainted with one of the witnesses in the case, who is a central person in the state's case and would be testifying about fairly sensitive material. Therefore, he had concluded this created too close a connection to the central witness. The afternoon's first would-be juror and information technology administrator made clear his distrust of police and was summarily dismissed. You can get off this. You don't want to be part of this jury. There's a real quick, easy way for you to get off this jury. Not only did the man say he believes Chauvin caused Floyd's death with lethal force, but he said systemic racism runs through policing and law enforcement is over-militarized. He also said police do not make him feel safe in his community, mostly in light of everything that's been going on in this case and related cases, and I'm always wary of people with guns being in my general vicinity. The judge excused the prospective juror and noted he would have trouble finding a police officer as a credible witness. The questioning of jurors has also impacted since early last week by the viral video of the bystander shot showing Chauvin pinning the 46-year-old Floyd to the pavement by the knee more than 5 minutes until he became unresponsive and died. Well, he's actually unresponsive and died before that. But the there's a lot going on here. One thing that did not happen, although they did refer to it, Special Attorney for the State Jerry said Thursday that it's logical for Floyd to respond that way after an officer drew a gun on him and put him in the risk of having a head blown off for a fake $20 bill. Nelson countered that if Vincent can speak to Floyd's state of mind, then the defense should be able to present at trial some details about Floyd's behavior during his May 2019 drug-related arrest. The defense is desperate to get that earlier conflict with the police into the record, even though Derek Chauvin was not involved in that case at all. They're desperate to get it in there. I thought Cahill was going to rule on that today. I didn't see anything specifically in the story about that. I'm a little concerned about whether or not, I haven't tell you the truth. I'm a little concerned about, what that's going to be, where they're going to do, if they're going to do anything with that. And once again, keeping up to date with the Unicorn Riot, like I said, this story only talked about the two of the new jurors that were put out today. Unicorn Riot says a third juror was added, and they were talking to juror 95. They still have not announced whether juror 95 is going to make the jury or not. But if jury 95 makes it, then they're at 13. How, if you can find 13 jurors, all you need is one more, and you got the full jury allotment. Then at what point do you have the justification to move this trial out of Minneapolis, out of Hennepin County? I don't think you will. It'll be interesting. Tomorrow's a big day. Tomorrow's a big day. He's going to rule on whether he's going to delay the trial or he's going to move the trial. I have a hard time believing a judge, if he's got 13 jurors, if he gets this last juror seated, but even if he has 12, he has 12 already. But if he's got 12, it's not impossible to find jurors. So, and they've got, what, 2 weeks? Another week to find two more jurors. I think they should be able to. And both sides still have plenty of strikes left. So I can't see how this would be, this is going to get moved. I'd be shocked. I'd be angry, too, if it does. 952-946-6205. I got to ask about some police actions, though, when I do return. Because there are some things that are a little concerning to me, and I want to get to those. Once again, Dan Dicker is going to join us, author of Turning Oil Green, How You Become a Green Energy Through the Markets. We'll talk to him coming up here about 4:35. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Dan Dicker, once again, going to join us, the author of Turning Oil Green. We'll talk about it. He's a markets expert, and he feels as if the way to do this, if to go to green energy, is through the markets. He's got a new book out. We'll talk to him about that coming up here in just a few minutes. So we talked a little bit about my concern with this juror who's got a relative who's on the Minneapolis Police Department, and I don't think it's science fiction to ask the question, would the police union find out who this juror is, find out which relative it is, and kind of, you know, you know, encourage the juror to go talk to the relative. I don't think it's science fiction. I don't think it's science fiction at all. I don't think it's, I'm not saying it has happened. I'm not saying it will happen, but I'm saying that's my concern about that juror right there. And before anyone, once again, most police officers are absolutely outstanding individuals. Most police officers are really good people. Most sheriff's deputies are really good people. I am talking solely about the city of Minneapolis Police Department. I have watched as this police department has, I've had friends who have had questionable encounters with them. We have watched the record of their treatment of the African-American population in the city. There clearly is a lot of problems. The union is clearly out of control. And it seemed to be just a place of power that was enabled by a lot of the Minnesota Republicans. We saw that after the George Floyd trial, we saw them target the media specifically in the troubles afterwards, which was they were clearly going after the media multiple times. And yesterday we heard that story from the one juror that the police were coming into their neighborhoods. And playing after, I'm presuming it's after any time an African-American got shot by the police, would play the Queens, the band Queens, Another One Bites the Dust, in the neighborhood. And by God, if that doesn't call for a full investigation, I don't know what is. I have gotten a lot of people who have sent me video of the so-called police action the other day in George Floyd Square. Where they say this wasn't, they said they were taking down a gunman. What they've taken video and what I've seen video of is what looks more like a parade where a truck drives in and everyone's waving at the crowd and sirens are on and flashing lights are up. And it sure seemed like it was much more an attempt at intimidation than it was any kind of legitimate police action. I mean, there seems to have been something going on there because I got tons of video of that. And then I saw this post of a Minneapolis police officer. Hadn't seen the pleasure of meeting this officer yet. She had her badge taped over, but is 16, 17. Tried to hit me with her car. I don't know what the rest of this, but apparently I was a little, their badge was covered up. Which led to someone else, a guy named Finnegan, putting out Minneapolis PD Section 3116. Uniformed MPD employees shall wear an authorized breast badge on the outermost garment and shall be clearly visible, shined, and in good repair. So clearly, there's a question here is if the rule is you have to have your badge visible, then if officers are taping up their badges and covering them up, what's going on here? This is, there is a lot here right now that has me just perplexed. And what you're seeing is now this push to reopen the George Floyd Square. And once again, I'll go back to what I said last week, which was about when we're talking about these autonomous zones. That autonomous zones, fine, if you're going to do this, you have to realize you have to then become the police within that autonomous zone. And what it seemed to me is there was a lot of people that were trying to keep police out, but didn't really seem to be too concerned about what was going on within the autonomous zone, as they were trying to take control over. And you've got clear crime problems. You've got people that are not going down there. It sounds like during the day, there's a lot of people coming by and paying tribute to George Floyd and wanting to be there and witness, which is fine, which is great. But it sounds like at night, the place is becoming tough. And yeah, and I said this, if you want to do an autonomous zone, you've got to run an autonomous zone. You've got to police it. Minneapolis police say they're going to go back in. How that takes shape, we don't know. But I've got more. I mean, when I hear the Another One Bites the Dust story, when I see these videos, which don't look like any kind of police activity I've ever seen, look far more like just a police intimidation attempt. And when I see police officers not having their badge number showing because they want to keep it hidden, well, you don't want to be a cop, then you don't have to be a cop. You can go get another job. I've got more questions now. And once again, I think there needs to be investigation into all these things. You know, are police officers not letting their badges be seen? Did the police actually just go in there and do a dog and pony show to try to scare the people of George Floyd Square? Are they going into South Minneapolis after black people are shot and playing Another One Bites the Dust by Queen? Because if any of that's true, all those people need to be gone. Clean house. Fire them. Because they should not be police officers. Protect and Serve is on that badge. It's on the side of your cars, too. And God, you guys don't do crap. That you're just horrible at that. Minneapolis police, you guys got a lot of explaining to do at this point. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Change direction here with, once again, Dan Dicker is going to join us. Turning Oil Green is his latest book. We'll talk to him in just a moment. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Let's welcome on in Dan Dicker. He is an energy trader. He has worked in financial markets and a financial advisor. He's been a pundit on CNBC, Bloomberg US. He writes for The Street. He's the author of a few books, including Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. And he's got a brand new book that's coming on out, Turning Oil Green, a market-based path to renewables. Dan Dicker is kind enough to join us today to talk about this new book. Hi, Dan. Thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
My pleasure. First of all, I got to tell you the truth. I've actually, someone recommended your Shale Boom, Shale Bust book. I'd actually heard of it. I had not read it yet because I got a list. But, you know, it's I recommended that book. You seem to bring, as a mutual friend of ours said, an interesting perspective, kind of a liberal in the energy trading markets.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, most of the folks that I've met in my career are very right-leaning. I mean, the oil market and the commodities market tend to draw more right-leaning folks. But, I'm a traditional liberal, and so I see things from a unique perspective. So I have, some idea of what the motivations are of the industry and the people who are in the industry. And I also understand, where they're right and, where they're mostly wrong. And on the left, too, I sort of have a pretty good perspective on where they're right and, where they get a couple of things wrong, too.
Well, and I think kind of one of the points of your book is a major thing. And I agree with you, actually, on this, because I'm a business major. There's this mentality when it comes to going to green energy, to getting onto renewable energy, that one day it's going to be like the end of a movie. We all walk outside hand in hand, march off into the sunset. And it doesn't work that way. You need to have the markets on board with it because that's really going to be your primary driver to get to more renewable fuels.
Yeah, I mean, the history of energy is pretty clear. It's sort of like the evolution of man, mm-hmm. Where you don't really start from an ape, and then the next step is that you become, what we look like. There's stages and there's transitions that you have to go through, and that's just the way it works. So the idea that we're going to walk out one day and the entire world is going to be nothing but Teslas, it's a false hope, and it doesn't really, it doesn't really respect what's possible. Well, and so what I try to do is I try to lay out, what is possible, and that's really what's important here.
Well, and it's a nice feeling. It's a nice concept. I mean, we look at Denmark and, wow, they're almost all renewable energy. But you don't realize, they've been doing that since 1970. They've been moving in that direction. It is something that you have to have pretty much everyone on board if you're going to do it that way. And right now, as you kind of say, you have a lot of people that are driving the energy markets. They're just not on board with something like this.
Yeah, and the truth of the matter is you're going to need some of these oil companies to be on board. And I know it's counterintuitive. It's not what the left wants to hear. But the truth is they have a lot of money that's available to invest in the energy world. They own all the infrastructure in this country. And they've got the experience in what it takes to move, transport, and get to end users energy of all sorts. And trying to recreate that, from scratch, it's not necessary. And we shouldn't waste the time to do it. We're in a rush here. We got to get to a green future as quick as we can. And what I try to convince people of is that you can't do it without the help of the oil and gas companies. And they've been very willing to be a part of this green revolution. I mean, they're doing it reluctantly, but they've shown more and more in the last 2 years how much they need to be a part of this green revolution. And we've got to stop vilifying them. We've got to bring them into the you know, into the transition, because that's the way we get there the quickest.
And you actually bring up in your book how we're actually at a prime time to kind of push them towards this, because coronavirus has really done a number on the fossil fuel industry, correct?
Absolutely. And they've been just beaten up for the past 6 years in trying to be, you know, alone. We're, you know, in an oil environment. We're going to be in an oil environment. We're never going to change. And they've gotten punished for that. They've gotten punished by the public. They've gotten punished by shareholders, which is where it really counts. Shareholders have stopped investing with them, and they're demanding them to make a change and be part of this energy revolution. And they are, you know, they're investing a lot of money to try and be part of this energy revolution. And so you have to allow them to be a part of that.
The thing that always concerns me about the energy sector, though, when it comes to green technology, is it feels as if the mentality is that the current fossil fuel industry needs to have almost complete control of whatever renewable energies are going to come on down the line before they'll really kind of embrace them. It'd be like if Big Horseshoe, back when cars got introduced, demanded they're in charge of all the steel, the glass, the gasoline, the oil, and the rubber before they would allow cars to get out there. And it almost, there does seem to be this mentality that if we can't win with oil, well, then we need to position ourselves in the markets to be there and be in control before we'll even start embracing that. Is that true? Or is that just my perspective on that?
No. They would like to. I mean, they would like to, whatever you pump into your car or whatever transport you use in 2060, you know, they want Exxon on top of whatever station you're filling it with, no matter what you're filling it with, whether it's hydrogen or electricity or a natural gas, no matter what it is, they'd like to be the one filling your tank. But the truth is, this is the time to actually put some regulation back into place. Control the price of energy products. Control how much they can, the oil companies can invest in drilling more energy products. And with some of these market, you know, controls that I sort of talk about, you can allow for not only to respect and keep together the oil industry as it is and protect some of those jobs, but also very much support these new technologies that this country is building to, you know, take over and try and displace some of these fossil fuels as quickly as we possibly can.
Once again, Dan Dicker joining us. Turning Oil Green is the book. I know that, and there are people out there that, once again, they like that dream world where they wake up one day and everything's Teslas. But the reality is it's going to take a while to get there. You kind of put a lot of faith in natural gas, and you say that, you know, that kind of a gateway drug to get us from the fossil fuel industry into the more green technology. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, it's a natural transition. Just like, you know, we've gone from wood to coal to oil, you know, and all of these old technologies kind of die out. You know, the next step on this is so clearly natural gas. So from an environmental point of view, it's instantaneously 50% cleaner than oil. I mean, that's an instant benefit for everybody. It's more efficient when you burn it. It goes in, you know, you don't have to turn it into another product. For example, crude oil is useless. You got to turn it into gasoline or jet fuel or heating oil or something else in order to use it. But natural gas comes out of the well. It goes through a pipe and it comes out in your kitchen or wherever you need it in the same form as it comes out. So that's also a benefit. And, you know, finally, you know, it has every use that oil does and several more. You can take it and you can convert it into anything you want. For example, there's now a very big hype going on around hydrogen.
Yeah.
Well, 95% of the hydrogen that's made right now is made from natural gas. And hydrogen in its form is, you know, as good as electricity. It's got zero emissions when you put it in or you drive a car with it or a truck or whatever you use to do to power something. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons that, you know, we're very late to this, but it's not too late. We really have to make a transition to natural gas first or before we get, or at least while we're getting towards some of these zero carbon technologies like solar and wind and so forth.
How much can natural gas, do you think, replace the dirtier fossil fuels? Do you think, are we looking at the ability to take over? I mean, because obviously, like crude oil, they use in plastics, and there's other things, too, that are there. And the reality is how much do you think when it comes to, not pumping oil, per se, for energy use, do you think natural gas could consume that part of their market?
In this country, the sky's the limit. We are the largest producer of fossil fuels in the world. And we have an enormous reserve of new fracked natural gas that we've been flooded with and been glutted with for the past 10 years. The prices of natural gas are insanely cheap compared to oil. And most of the natural gas producers in this country are going broke because there's so much of it and nobody wants it, or at least they want it in such a small quantity that it remains cheap and they can't make a living. So to the degree that we could switch over to natural gas, it's an instant winner. It's cheaper, it's cleaner, it's in this country, it's far more easy to get out of the ground. And we've got a lot of it that would last us, if we converted for 150 years before we run out of at least what we know is in the ground, and there may be a lot more. So in terms of transition and what natural gas can do for us, the sky is kind of the limit.
If we did, let's go hypothetical, if we did really embrace natural gas as a transition, a natural transition, as you said, then how long do you think it would take for us to get to that 100% green renewable energy down the road? Is this something that would be attainable, say, in my lifetime?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, what we're looking at is we're looking at these kinds of building, this kind of evolution like I talk about. So you're never going to see oil disappear completely. I mean, we still burn wood, as old as that technology is, and we still burn coal, as silly as that and old as that technology is. And you're never going to eliminate completely oil or natural gas. But yeah, the quicker you can make those transitions, the less of a percentage of the portfolio the dirtier stuff takes up in what you need to power a planet. So, yeah, you go to natural gas, you're immediately giving an incentive to use less oil, to use less coal, and you're also giving an incentive to use more of the renewable energies like solar and wind. So, yeah, I mean, the quicker you make the transition, the quicker you can make the next transition.
The real question, and traders, the inside of the energy market a lot better than I do. There are a lot of people that basically said when the last drop of oil is out of the ground in any capacity, then we'll think about it. How likely is it, do you think, that, I mean, you make some good points in the sense that, you're already warming up way too fast. You're not going to be able to reverse this quickly, but you definitely need to get the oil industry on board. Is there really a hope that we could get, some more calmer minds in place here to where that what you're saying is not science fiction per se, as far as a market-based strategy to get us to renewables, that it's something that's actually got an applicable time frame?
Well, Matt, I mean, that's kind of why I wrote the book. I mean, we live in obviously a very partisan country. And somewhere along the line, we've got to have, an honest conversation not only about climate change, but about this myth of, oil companies controlling, political parties and doing what they want and being unregulated and having a Wild West time in the marketplace and having no controls whatsoever. There comes a moment where if you're going to be really serious about changing, the path that we're going and really serious about climate, you're going to have to not only involve the oil companies and allow them to make a profit, but also control them when they get undisciplined, which they do a lot.
Yes.
And so, and what's the hope for that? What's the actual hope for that? The political, landscape out there as well as I do, despite the fact that it's probably, not the most likely thing in the world, it was a book I felt I needed to write. I hope that, it helps educate, people in Washington and around the country in, a plan that's possible that does protect the oil industry as well as help us move forward to a greener future. But, to the degree that that's going to happen, I don't know, Matt. You tell me.
I like your ideas. I mean, I agree with you. There's sometimes there's too much pie in the sky on the left and on how this is going to get done. You're going to need to run this through the markets. And so I like how you're looking at this for a real practical way as to put it through the markets. Yeah, I you know, we got a lot of people to change the mind on, but I'll encourage the book. Go get the book, Turning Oil Green, Dan Dicker. You'll find it over at Next Chapter Books over in St. Paul. Also, Amazon, Kindle, it's available there. Dan, all my best with this. Congratulations on the third book, and hope to talk to you again sometime.
Anytime, Matt. I appreciate it.
Dan Dicker, kind enough to join us. Once again, Turning Oil Green, a market-based path to renewables. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our live call-in talk show airing every Saturday from noon to 1, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights you need to know to live and age well. Each week, we talk with guests who provide answers to important questions regarding healthcare, elder care, end-of-life care, and self-care for caregivers, and help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to 1 on AM 950 for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. You know, I know, I'm going to be honest with you. I know a lot of listeners out there are going to be like, Matt, what are you bringing this guy on for? There is, I'm a very practical person. I am. And, you know, I don't remember. Do you remember when people were talking about trying to start another Continental Congress? And the way people were saying is, we're going to do it again. And then we're all going to walk arm in arm up the stairs and go in there and rewrite the Constitution to where everyone has it. And I said, no, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is this. You're going to start this. And as you head to the building where they're going to be writing the new Constitution, corporate America is going to send in the troops to beat the living daylights out of you, lock the doors, rewrite the Constitution as they want it, and then basically you have to sit there and go, oh, sorry. Democrats have there are way too many Democrats that like to pat themselves on the back and have the end of the movie, happy sunset, yay, we won, like, there's an ending to any of this. Seriously, there's no ending to any of this. In 2008, Barack Obama became president, and then basically everyone, I guess, thought there was not going to be another election. Because in 2010, Democrats didn't show up for anything. And as a matter of fact, Democrats turned on their own what should have been their landmark bill for the next 40 years, the Affordable Care Act, and criticized it more than the Republicans did. Because they didn't, we need to be ashamed of this, please. It was ludicrous. We all like the winner story. We all like the idea of, you know, at the end. And trust me, I am, when it comes to green technology, I'm all for it. I have lived in Minnesota. I have been in these pristine areas. I am not a fan of Line 3. I sure as hell do not want a precious metals mine controlled by some Chilean overlord in northern Minnesota, destroying that property. These projects that you put out there that are horrible, I'm not for. I grew up in Minnesota. My dad, he said his two favorite colors are blue and green. Why? Blue for the water and the sky, green for the trees. And I'm the same way. We have such a wonderful environment here in Minnesota that is under siege as we speak. And green technology is the way to go. You could build more windmills. You could build more solar panels like a lot of places do. And you're going to go a long way. A long way. But there is a reality to this in that right now, the entire narrative is being directed by the oil industry, by the coal industry. I mean, for God's sakes, even the coal industry was telling Trump, we don't need that. You don't have to do that. During his term, he was trying to, you know, get them, you know, give them more. And they're like, we can't. We're not going, we don't, that's not, you don't have to pander to us that much. What Dan Dicker is doing here is trying to write a book which shows those people, the oil uber-allis people, that there is a path here that can make you money that gets you to green technology. And yeah, natural gas is a fossil fuel and it's not necessarily healthy. His point is very valid, though. It is a lot cleaner than you know, oil, gasoline, a lot cleaner than coal. And if you use that as a gateway to get to more green technology and green energy, well, you know, I think that that's something that's tolerable. But the idea that tomorrow we're going to be able to stop the oil drills and the oil pipelines tomorrow and then boom, I guess windmills and solar panels are going to just magically appear. That's just not going to happen. So we have to have a strategy. Now, granted, I disagree with Dan to a point. I don't think you need to pander as much as you need to the economic sector. But you have to have a game plan. Stopping Line 3, that's a game plan. Stop it. Stop Line 3. Stop the precious metal mines. Stop that. All you're doing is building more infrastructure, which really is going to be dated anyway here in probably a few decades at most. You need to get people out there building windmills, getting more solar power out there, and investing in those technologies. And if you do that and you start making money, because I can tell you right now, there's a lot of countries right now that have a lot of technology and they're making a lot of money for the private sector because decades ago they started focusing on solar panels and decades ago they started focusing on how to get every gigawatt and kilowatt out of a windmill. And they've become the experts on it. If we can get rid of the oil barons of the world and get us onto green technology, that's a win. It's not going to happen overnight, so you have to create a plan how it's going to happen. That's what I kind of like a little bit about Dan Dicker's book, though. It at least gives us a plan to get there as opposed to just hoping it gets there. 952-946-6205. Sven Sundgaard coming up next hour. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Hour two today, Sven Sundgaard's going to join us. My allergies are finally clearing up here. Nothing like a little snow to basically get things going on that. Just an update here. Juror 95 was dismissed. Says he felt he was overly influenced by coverage of the Minneapolis civil settlement with the Floyd family, so he did not get seated. But by my count, we were up to 12 jurors. And like I said, I have a hard time believing that, that if you got 12 and you just need two more for alternates, you know, you're basically, you know, it'd be one thing if you had four at this point, but you got 12. I'd be find it very hard to believe that they're going to move the venue. Whether they delay it, that's a different question. I don't know. We'll have to see on that. 952-946-6205. So, Patrick, I want to ask you. Well, first of all, I got to send you over to my Twitter feed for pictures of a baby platypus. Holy God, is it the cutest damn little thing I've ever seen in my entire life. At Matt McNeil Show on Twitter. At Matt McNeil Show. Look at the photos. And, oh, my God, it's so cute. It's so cute and adorable. Oh, and it's not just talking about the pictures of me on there. Bridge troll. So did you see the pictures of that, Patrick?
You know, it's so cute. It's like a duck mammal. Like,
is this your first platypus you've seen?
No, it's not. But, I mean, the resemblance is particularly strong when it's that little.
It's just, he's got a little claws. He's like, I'm playing, and I'm a tough guy. Oh, it's just adorable. Speaking of also adorable, the Justice League Snyder Cut. So we have, Patrick, if you are a fan of the superhero comic book stuff, two different things happening. Today, I believe, the Zack Snyder version of the Justice League movie is being released, which was like 3 hours long, isn't it? Or something like that?
I'm not sure. I don't really follow movies that closely.
You don't? Well, did you watch anything like on, you know, did you catch any of like the WandaVision that was on Disney?
I did not. I don't have Disney Plus.
Okay. Well, I did. I saw WandaVision. It was quite good. They're now going to do Falcon and the Winter Soldier. That's tomorrow. So you have all that going. And then they just announced the Loki series is going to start. I'm going to get, they say it's in June, so I'm going to guess it's kind of, there'll be a few weeks off after the end of Falcon and Winter Soldier, and they're going to start the Loki series. They've made a juggernaut there. Now people are always going to go back and look at the attempts to start Marvel movies before and ask the question, is like, how do guys not just do this? Well, I guess you had to start with Iron Man because Robert Downey Jr. is just, he is Tony Stark. But, you know, now it's just, it's everything they do is a juggernaut. I'm encouraged by this because I think the Falcon and Winter Soldier, the WandaVision was so good. And so in my mind, it did exactly what the movies had done, which is dance the fine line between a fan base of a comic book, which has had stories that have unfolded over 40, 50 years. I mean, I think Scarlet Witch started appearing in the comic books in the 60s, in the mid-60s. And making something that's applicable today that is translatable without having to do the three movies of The Hobbit sort of thing, you know, where you can kind of get it concise and quick and be done with it. Catherine Hahn, by the way, Agatha Cartwright, Agatha Harkness in the WandaVision was fantastic. So I'm looking forward to this. The Justice League movie. I'm not a DC guy. I'm just not a DC guy. I grew up with Spider-Man. I grew up with Captain America and the Avengers. I did not grow up. I mean, I had friends who loved Batman. And friends who love Superman. I just was never into the DC movies. Did you were you DC or Marvel as a kid? Did that apply?
Well, I was a DC guy. I watched the Batman animated series. It was kind of it was actually when I think it came out, it was more meant for a prime time, you know, more of an adult viewing audience. So stories were a little deeper, a little darker sometimes. So I grew up with that, but the tables turn because Marvel, well, frankly, they make good movies. DC doesn't.
They don't. Oh, I watched Man of Steel. I finally watched that one. I'm like, oh, come on, wrap it up here. And that's a shame. That's a shame. And it's now that's the Batman. How old are you? Can I ask Patrick, how old are you?
I am 30.
You zygote. Dude, I was watching the Batman from the 60s. That was, you know, that was part of the reason why probably I was never much into Batman because it was so cartoonish. That was such a cartoonish show that it kind of broke away. Although I will say when I was a kid, I'll give Christopher Reeve, when he did his Superman, the first two movies were quite exceptional. And Superman 2, people forget how big that movie was when he took on Zod and those guys. That was a huge moment. They finally kind of brought Superman into the Star Wars realm. But you know, it was that was a great film. I enjoyed those first two. It never resonated like the other ones. I just thought the stories were much better. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't know. Do I get invested? Do I start watching the Zack Snyder, you know, Justice League?
But what did you think of the original non-director's cut?
Not good. It wasn't bad. There were some fun moments, but it wasn't great. And I'll say this, and I know that some people are going to get mad at me. Ben Affleck's Batman was actually one of the more entertaining elements of that. I kind of tried to hold that movie together. But no, that movie, that was a big old swing and a miss. And it doesn't, it doesn't help. You go watch Captain America Winter Soldier. That's just a great spy movie. Whoever wrote that movie, you know, deserves, you know, that movie is insanely good. There's enough of those Ragnarok, Thor Ragnarok. Yeah, it's in space and Jeff Goldblum's in full Goldblum. But still, I mean, that movie, that's enjoyable. It's a much more enjoyable experience than anything I've had in a DC movie. I will watch it and I'll give a report on Monday because I sure don't have time tonight to sit down for a 3-hour movie. And I've got kids. I got a life to live. I can't just, hey, I guess I'm going to sit around on a Friday and watch movies all day. I can't do that. Okay, I could. But still, I mean, I like to pretend I actually have some responsibilities and important things to do in this world. So 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Sven Sundgaard is going to join us, talk a little bit about some weather things when we do have him come back here in about 20 minutes or so. Minnesota has reached two very different milestones in the COVID-19 pandemic, reporting on Thursday that more than 500,000 people have suffered known infections and more than 2 million doses of vaccine have been administered. Now, I want to stop and go with the 500,000. A year ago, and I talked a little earlier about that going to church and stuff like that, when we're talking about bikes, which, by the way, someone told me if you want to go bike, you can find them online on like Craigslist and stuff. There's a tons of bikes for sale there. But I'll never forget, because Trump was playing down coronavirus, how many people were screaming that, you know, it's nothing. It's like the flu. This is no big deal. We have had 500,000 people in the state of Minnesota alone sickened by coronavirus. And that's the ones we know. There are a lot of people who are asymptomatical, might not have gotten tested. 500,000 people. The good news, though, once again, 2 million doses of the vaccine have been administered. The notable figures come as state health officials assess the slight uptick in COVID-19 activity in Minnesota, despite more than 23% of people receiving vaccine against the infectious disease. That includes 77% of senior citizens who have suffered 89% of Minnesota's 6,762 COVID-19 deaths. That total includes 6 new deaths that were reported on Thursday. Hope is on the horizon, said Governor Tim Walz in a statement regarding the vaccine milestone, despite being quarantined himself until March 25th due to a viral exposure. By the way, I'll say this. I think the reason why you're seeing an uptick is that people feel as if, well, people are getting vaccinated, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. It's not the people who are being vaccinated that are doing the reckless behavior per se. It's the people that think, well, vaccines are happening, so we can go back to normal. And I think that that's where the problem is. The emergence of more infectious variants of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 appears to be fueling some of the increase in pandemic activity despite the vaccination process. The positivity rate for diagnostic testing had dropped from a peak of 15.4 on November 9th to 3.3 on March 3rd. It's now at 4.1. It is slowly climbing back up again. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Minnesota also have increased. Hospitals reporting a doubling of cases requiring intensive care from 37 on March 6th to 74 on Wednesday. However, the hospital figure remains below the peak of 399 COVID-19 ICU admissions that was on December 1st. The latest weekly COVID-19 activity report from the Department of Health showed continued increase in diagnosed infections among K-12 school children. More than 600 diagnosed infections of K-12 students and staff were detected in the 7-day period ending March 13, compared to a weekly tally of 400 the week ending February 14th. So once again, more than 600 diagnosed K-12 students and staff in the 7-day period ending March 13th, a dramatic tally. Then 400 was what they had on February 14th. Heightened testing of K-12 students is somewhat responsible for the increase in the detection in some cases of asymptomatic infections that might not have otherwise been found. However, both the rate and testing of positivity has increased in 10 to 19 age group in Minnesota, suggesting an actual increase in viral transmission. Well, you're going to get the guys together, and my kids have said that when they're going to school that they're not allowed to, kind of mingle in the hall. But I guarantee you there's probably places where people are mingling in the halls. The six deaths reported on Thursday included 4 people 65 and older, 2 residents of long-term care facilities. Friday is the anniversary of Minnesota's first COVID-19 death. An 88-year-old in St. Paul resident who had been in contact with relatives who had traveled outside the country. There's also one of the things that we have talked about are the long-term effects of this. Washington Post actually has two stories I'm going to touch on here that I'm going to highly recommend. And I know when I post these stories, it's a paywall, but I actually recommend the Post. I recommend the Times as well. But before the coronavirus pandemic, 13-year-old Madeline Maddie Dayton played volleyball and basketball and ran track. She attended in-person school and still had plenty of energy left over to race around her small town of Cokeville, Wyoming with friends. Today, more than 6 months after being infected with the virus, she's struggling with lingering effects of the illness. While doctors recently cleared her for a limited physical activity, Maddie estimates she can only do about half of what she used to do. Even Zoom school can be too much some days. She'll zonk out in front of her computer, her mother said, and I'll have to wake her up. Cases of children with persistent symptoms after COVID-19 are rare but growing, doctors say, unnerving parents and physicians who are tracking an often strange and fluctuating constellation of symptoms. On Facebook support groups and other social media, families describe the struggles to be taken seriously and express frustration that basic scientific knowledge is lacking about what is going on. Many of the children who suffer from enduring effects report they continue to feel lousy even though they have cleared the virus and are not suffering from obvious organ damage, and their scans, blood work, and other tests come back clean. There have been a few other people, non-kids, who have said the same thing. Public health officials and scientists often talk about how children have been largely spared from the devastation of COVID-19, but their story is incomplete without understanding long haulers. Nearly 3.17 million U.S. children have tested positive for the virus. Few have been hospitalized and even fewer have died, but some children, whether they had mild or severe cases or no symptoms at all, are developing problems that last for weeks or months after their initial infection. According to surveys and studies of small groups in children, the symptoms include fatigue, headache, and heart palpitations. That's not good. In the early months of the pandemic, when many children sheltered at home, the phenomenon of long COVID appeared to be limited to adults. But as school, sports, and other activities started up, it became clear children were vulnerable too. The World Health Organization has recognized that COVID-19 can sometimes result in prolonged illness even in young adults and children without underlying chronic medical conditions, but efforts to characterize the illness so far have relied mostly on phone surveys, case studies, and anecdotal evidence. A growing number of medical centers, Boston Children's Hospital, Kennedy Krieger Institute, Baltimore, the National Jewish Health in Denver, and Norton Children's Hospital in Louisville, are setting up multidisciplinary clinics to try to better understand and treat these patients. And a research project funded by the National Institute of Health that is getting underway will explore the range of impacts COVID-19 has on children. The children infected with the COVID-19 are believed to suffer from two distinct illnesses. The first is acute infection with the virus that might lead to respiratory distress, blood coagulation issues, and multi-system organ involvement similar to what adults experience. There's also mysterious and rare but serious inflammatory illness known as MISC that is limited to pediatric patients and a handful of young adults and appears to occur weeks or months after infection. Formal data on how many children are affected is spotty and incomplete, but Britain's Office of National Statistics reported numbers last month that took doctors by surprise. Among children younger than 11 with confirmed positive cases, 13% had at least one symptom 5 weeks after infection. Fatigue was the most common complaint, but the affected children also described respiratory problems, insomnia, and other issues. For 12 to 16-year-olds, 15% had at least one lingering symptom. In adults, it ranged from 18% in people 70 and older to nearly 27% in people 35 to 49. We are just starting to understand the long-term effects of this crisis. And when you're talking about children experiencing heart palpitations months after being cleared of coronavirus, and once again, there is nothing else they have. There is no other illness. There's no other pre-existing condition. There's nothing that it clearly seems to be tied back to the coronavirus. Well, how many years are we going to be dealing with this? And I'm not going to get necessarily too upset at the scientists, because once again, you're on a moving playing field at this point. But I think we are, and as the story alludes to, initially, we were hearing of adults having these lingering symptoms, But now you're hearing from these kids. People, wear your mask, wash your hands, social distance. We've got a long way to go here. Please. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I'll get to the other Washington Post story when I do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is the Matt McNeil Show. Is Minnesota emerging COVID-19 hotspot in the U.S.? According to the Washington Post, Minnesota is among the states that are seeing case levels creep in the wrong direction. We are experiencing a journey right now with this virus, as our friends in Europe are experiencing, said Osterholm during an appearance. Unfortunately, we still have 50 to 55% of the U.S. population that are still are susceptible to this virus, meaning they have not previously been infected, nor have they had access to vaccine yet. This is what you and I have been talking about for weeks, and now, unfortunately, it's here, Osterholm said, of the B117 variant, commonly known as the UK variant because it was first discovered in Europe. The B117 variant has been the cause of concern in Carver County, where case levels have been increasing due to an outbreak at the Minnesota Department of Health has connected to school sports. Carver County saw a 62% increase in cases from February 24th to March 4th. Another COVID outbreak 60 miles north of the Twin Cities was identified this week in Pine City. At their high school, it switched from in-person learning to distance learning after 9 students tested positive and approximately 90 other students were advised to quarantine after a possible exposure. Dr. David Hilden of Hennepin Healthcare says the case increases in Minnesota are scattered throughout the state. We are starting to see just a slight uptick in the number of cases in Minnesota, said Hilden. Hospitalizations or death do tend to lag case increases by a few weeks, so it's a little bit concerning. The slight increase comes as Minnesota's economic and social safety measures have been relaxed by Governor Walz. Bars and restaurants are open 75% capacity. Gyms can operate at 50% capacity, and social gatherings are allowed more people for more households. Sporting events will start being allowing fans in, depending on if they're indoor or outdoor. The relaxed restrictions are partially a result of Minnesota's vaccination progress. As of March 15th, more than 1.2 million Minnesotans received at least one dose. We know that's now up higher. You know, first of all, this story just to me highlights the double-edged sword it is to be Governor Walz at this point. On one side, you have every Republican screaming, "Open everything! There is nothing to fear!" And they'll say it like that, and then they'll come back and say, you know, when we said there's nothing to fear, what we really mean to say is, you know, you should wear your mask and you should socially. It's not our responsibility if you get sick. We're just basically doing everything we can to serve you up on a platter for coronavirus. But I mean, it's on you then, huh? Yeah, they roasted you. They're trying to roast you, but they're blaming you because you didn't season yourself correctly. You know, on the other side, you've got people, and I got to admit, I'm kind of on the other side. I think we're pushing this a little too early, and it's because I think people hear the word vaccination, and they think, yeah, we're fine. I know multiple people who are planning fairly substantial spring break trips, and my first response is, really? Oh, yeah, we're going to go down. So we're on the plane for a little bit. Everyone wears their masks. Fine. It's like, okay, you have to remind yourself that the chances of something like this, you know, becoming bad are pretty good. I mean, this is going to start spiking again. And it's unfortunate because there are, you know, because of Trump, and one of the long-term legacies of that jackass has to be that you had a massive pandemic problem and he just never took it seriously. He never took it seriously. And because he decided to, because he always had to play, looking for an angle, a conflict angle. I mean, people ask me all the time, it's like, gosh, how do we get past our conflict? Well, getting rid of Trump is a big plus because that was his modus operandi. Donald Trump would go on out on stuff that was never considered controversial and did his best to make it controversial, something a lot of his supporters eagerly did. Remember when he attacked family members of military dead? I remember when he attacked the family members of the military dead. I remember when he attacked POWs. We never had a president that did that. And up until Trump, any president even dreamed of saying something so obnoxious would have been run from office. And all of his Trump supporters came out and ran, oh, isn't he so presidential? Yeah, John McCain wasn't a nice guy. I wish these family members of the dead military would just shut up. He's the real hero, Donald Trump is. You know, he convinced you people that this is not serious and this is going to get worse. I think we should still be locked down to a point. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong on that. But I will say that there is a lot of stories out right now about how the most ardent Trump supporters, many of them elderly, are refusing, even as Trump has started saying, you know, hey, getting vaccinated is not the worst idea. They're refusing the idea of getting vaccinated. You can't stop people from being stupid. I mean, that should be the mantra of the Republican Party today. Republican Party of Minnesota, you can't stop people from being stupid. And before you guys say that's crossing a line, yeah, who had the party? Who likely killed one of their own senators? Ah, that's right, you guys did. Now, I think that the sad part is I think we're going to have, before this is all over, we're going to have a lot of these Trump Republicans that are going to be in the ICU screaming at nurses, this is a myth, as they're dying, as nurses are pleading with them to call loved ones because you're dying. And that is makes my heart heavy, because at the end of the day, I'm going to stand by what I said a year ago. I don't want you to die. I don't want anyone to die. I don't. Not from this. This is not the way that the greatest generation, the baby boomers, deserve to go out. This is not the way that any of us deserve to go on out. And no one is happy about businesses being closed. No one's happy about the economic restrictions we've had to put into place. No one is. But at the end of the day, we're trying to save as many lives as possible. And I don't want you to die, but I can't stop you from running out into traffic. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. When we come on back, Sven Sundgaard from Bring Me the News joins us. We'll talk weather. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Sven Sundgaard is kind enough to join us once again, a meteorologist extraordinaire over at bringmethenews.com. Of course, also Explore with Sven, and if you're not following his YouTube page, you need to be. Hey, Sven, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. You've gone out into nature a lot. I've got to ask you, did you ever interact with a platypus?
I have. Why do you ask that?
Because someone posted pictures, and I got it up on my Twitter feed, of a baby platypus, and holy God, is that like the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life.
And one of the most bizarre creatures you couldn't come up with something in your dreams like that if it didn't exist already. Oh. You know, a hairy duck, basically, that's a mammal, but lays eggs. And you know that males have a venomous claw in their back foot.
Okay, that's not attractive.
It's you know, obviously a defense mechanism, but it's toxic and can cause major pain to people and kill, of course, smaller things. But yeah, most bizarre. You know, I'd read an author once that said something to the effect of, if you don't think God or evolution or whatever you think is responsible for everything doesn't have a sense of humor, you've never seen a platypus.
I believe these are Australia, right? Or is that Tanzania? Where are they on? Okay.
Eastern Australia. They live in the shallow streams and ponds. And, you know, it's funny you bring it up. I actually talked about platypus just today with my students. That's kind of why. That's kind of why I wondered. It was, you know, it's not every day that one talks about platypus. But yeah, you know, with as the droughts and summer heat are increasing in Australia, they're getting kind of isolated more into smaller ponds. And I was showing them a video today of kind of some rescue missions where they've been pulling them out of basically all that was left were some puddles, and they had to move them to some other locations because they're not terrestrial. They don't move on land. So they're stuck, in a puddle if that's all that's really left. But yeah, I camped out. I was in Australia a couple of years ago, and one of the things, spent a few days on the Great Barrier Reef, and I'm like, I'm not leaving until I see a platypus. So I researched where a good spot would be in the area that I was in, which is the northeastern part of Australia, northern Queensland, and came across I can't remember the name of the village, but there's a stream. And I learned then that they're nocturnal. I was there in the afternoon. I'm like, I didn't see anything. And then towards dusk, all of a sudden you could see some movement. And I had to zoom in all the way with my camera, but sure enough, saw the bill. And so that was a confirmation.
Okay. So someone has to go into the muddy pond, pick up, yeah, and hope they've got the female, because the male is going to give them a good sting on the foot, I'm going to guess.
No, they use nets. And they're not as big as you think either. For some reason, most of us imagine them being bigger, but they're maybe 2 feet long.
That's still pretty big.
Yeah.
Of course, that's
weird.
The only thing Australia needs is more poisonous things. I mean, everything out there can kill you.
Yep.
Turning back to here a little closer to our country,
just a little.
Yeah, you basically have posted, and I love this, the songbird migration patterns. They are moving north. Nice. Oh yeah, well they're down in Missouri now. It looks like they're making their way back up here.
Yeah, the first wave of songbirds are on their way and will be here within, probably the next couple of weeks. I mean, it's weather dependent. So as we get warm spurts, they move further north rapidly, and then they kind of wait, if we get into colder periods. But probably a little ahead of schedule because of how mild March has been. But yeah, some of the early songbirds are making their way in, and even birds, it's a popular misconception. People think, oh, I saw a robin. Well, robins overwinter here.
Yeah.
Some robins migrate, but many do stay. But one of the things you'll notice is different if you're out in the mornings this time of year, sunny mornings, you'll hear a distinct spring indicator, which is their territory song, which they don't do in the winter. So they're starting to establish, zip codes and neighborhoods ahead of mating.
Well, I've already got one. They always try to build their nest on top of my lights on my house.
Yeah, that's a good spot, isn't it?
Well, it keeps them out of the rain. There's one place on the gutter I had like 3 years in a row. It's like, okay, no, enough, go, get out of here. But, it is nice. I mean, the Cardinals are already back there. What's going to be like the first one? If we can keep an eye out, which of this migrating pattern, which are some of the first ones? Not Canadian geese. I've already seen enough of them already.
Yeah, no, and they don't really. They do mini migrations, sort of like mallards, ducks. You know, as long as there's open water, you'll see them return. Mm-hmm. I'm not a total bird expert, so I can't say I know for sure. A lot of the ones that we recognize more need insects. So those are the ones we'll see later once we actually have consistently warm enough weather where there's bugs.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now the things we're seeing are the birds that are here are setting up territories and getting ready to mate. And there are baby owls. This is the time of year where the Wildlife Rehab Center gets kind of inundated, or the Raptor Center too, with baby owls, because there's the first to nest back in February, and they're falling out of trees now because they're big, and owls don't make their own nests. They just kind of are squatters, and you've seen a squirrel nest. That's a lot of times what they'll use, and it's just a pile of branches, and so they fall out frequently, and they're made to be pretty resilient, but people will see them and bring them in, and they kind of patch them up. And so if you see a baby owl, either call Wildlife Rehab Center or the Raptor Center first, because a lot of times we think we're doing the right thing. That's another good spring reminder. When you see baby robins or birds hopping around your yard, it's natural for them to fledge like that, and the parents will look after them and feed them for a few days until they're ready to fly, is usually the case. So, they'll give you specific instructions if the bird is injured or not.
I actually now I want to go out in the woods and see an owl fall out of a tree. I just want to, you know.
Baby owls are funny looking. It's like they haven't grown into their head yet. If you've ever seen one, like they have almost the adult sized head and those big googly eyes, you know, that look almost like the fake stick on eyes you put on, you know, craft arts and crafts.
Yeah.
But then this much smaller, super fluffy body, and like eagles, actually, they're by design made to not really be mobile. So that they don't to try to eliminate, you know, falls out of nests. So until a certain age, they don't really move except their head just to accept food from their parents. So they're just kind of, they look so awkward and goofy, just kind of sitting there with their head cocked.
I had a cousin that fell out of a lot of trees too. So, you know,
aren't designed for it so well, but.
He was fine. He kind of shaped the same way. Didn't grow into his head till years later, but he still, you know, he's fine. All right, the weather-wise, I got to ask you the question because you, on your latest video, which I posted today, go watch it. You talk about that the U.S. model is updating their formulas in this, and I kind of wonder because all right, we had the snow that came through earlier, and then all of a sudden, out of the blue, in the middle of the night, came down. At least in Hopkins, I had 2 more inches of snow that came on down that seemed to come out of nowhere. And I'm
That was Tuesday night, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
And I just kind of almost wonder, is that what this is about, is trying to, I mean, obviously there's a lot of really smart people out there working on this stuff. And weather is a wildly complicated thing that it's just, there's no way to, it's not the, like the days where the people would put magnetic things up on a magnetic board into a weather forecast.
Thankfully.
You know, yeah, it's so much more complicated. But the reality is it does kind of make people wonder. It's like, okay, how does snow kind of just materialize that no one really was forecasting, and all of a sudden, oh, by the way, we're going to get 2 inches tonight.
Yeah, and to meteorologists, those events are fun. I know to the average person, it's more of an annoyance, and then just gives them fuel to say, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. But to me, I like the fact that there are still things that can pop up and are unknown and, you know, unpredictable. That makes what we do exciting and, you know, room for improvement. You know, the thing with snow, I always tell people, because snow is multiplied by, you know, 8, 10, 20 times the precip amount, you have that much more room for variability too. And so, you know, like Tuesday night, most of the year, if that fell as rain, nobody would even think twice because we got, you know, a few hundredths of an inch of water. But with snow, all of a sudden now, yeah, you wake up to an inch of snow you didn't expect. So these little disturbances that can kind of, you know, pulses in the atmosphere are magnified in a snow event. And especially also this time of year where we're hyper aware of snow that falls when we didn't have any snow on the ground just a few days before. But, and I talked about the American model. So people always ask, well, which one's better? Well, they all have their own pluses and minuses. They all handle the physics of the atmosphere mathematically different, which is good in some situations and not as good in others. And the best way to explain to people, the European Meteorological Organization has one really good model, the European model. We have lots of good models, and the American model is one of those. So we have a slew of other models in the U.S. To choose from. The Canadian model is more powerful. It's just a more powerful supercomputer. So they just basically have invested their time, energy, and money into one model that does very well in a shorter term. And then the American model does good, but not necessarily as computationally as strong as the European model.
You know, I've never been a fan of weather people that, you know, kind of do the fear thing. It's like, it could be up to this, could be up to this. I will say one of the things I like about your weather forecast, what I like about a lot of the reports that you post in your weather forecast, is that it is truly remarkable. As a guy that grew up when people would draw on a board, and the first weather forecast I remember seeing as a kid were a guy putting up magnetic highs and lows and front lines and a rain cloud on.
Not
on
that long ago.
It wasn't. And so, you know, the reality is I to watch where we're at today and the fact that you can still predict, like that last snow, the major snow we had, not the overnight stuff, but the fact that you guys were able to look at that and you were willing to say, you know what, we're not sure because there's going to be a very narrow variant here. But, you know, you guys got it pretty close. I mean, I still think it is pretty amazing we have the ability to get it that synced as much as we can.
Well, and I'm glad you noticed that. People really only put away in their memory the botched storms or forecasts. But, yeah, like as you said, if you step back and think about that storm Monday, A, it's March. You know, any earlier late season storm is much more unpredictable than a midwinter storm. And yeah, you know, we had anywhere from an inch or two in Forest Lake to Mankato had a foot. That's what we were trying to forecast, you know, days in advance, that gradient. It moved a little further north than what it had looked like over the weekend. You know, my forecast Sunday evening was, I think, for Metro about 1 to 3. And then right away Monday morning, I got up and I saw the model runs overnight. I'm like, ooh, we're going to have to nudge this up a little in the South Metro. And sure enough, that's what happened. We ended up with 3 at the airport. So the Sunday forecast would have been accurate on the high end anyway. Mm-hmm. But some of the southern suburbs did get some 4 or 5 inch amounts. And yeah, trying to forecast that. And the fact that the models basically handled that storm pretty well days in advance is remarkable. And the other thing, too, with, you know, which is timely yesterday and today, the severe weather in the Southeast, the models have gotten so much better with severe weather. That short term forecast is really what's gotten remarkably better, just even in the last 10 years, noticeably better. So people always ask, well, hey, well, you know, will we be able to forecast a month or 3 months? That will get a little bit better over time, but you're ultimately dealing with chaos. You need to have perfect data to have a perfect forecast. So we will never have perfect data. We can get better data. Satellites have come a long way by giving us higher resolution data, you know, knowing what the temperature and conditions are over the oceans. Before, we had to basically guess between buoys or boats or airplanes. Now we have satellites give us a great estimation of what's going on big picture globally. But those short-term forecasts, the ability of short-term models to forecast when storms will form pretty close to where and how severe, I mean, that's saving lives and property, but also, you know, just for your day-to-day forecast is very useful.
Well, and you, whereas the southeastern United States, I mean, I have noticed they've got those storms that are rolling through right now. You know, they've been able to pinpoint those pretty accurately at this point.
Yeah, and to be able to give people the heads up, you know, one of the concerns that they've been having is, you know, last night is the possibility of overnight storms. You know, we don't luckily get much of that here. But that is kind of a common scenario in parts of the Southeast where storms initiate in the southwestern part of the Southeast, you know, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and then they can kind of roll across the Southeast. And, you know, if you're in eastern Alabama, a tornadic storm can happen at 2 a.m. And obviously 2 a.m. versus 2 p.m. is a much different scenario in terms of getting the warning out. But if you can tell people that day or the day before even, hey, before you go to bed, find a way to get information in case this happens. You know, think of even 10, 20 years ago, that was not really possible.
We don't have anything like that. Everyone needs to give Sven. Everyone needs to give Sven all the credit for what we're about to get here this weekend. Cause this weekend looks absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Another stunning weekend. We had a great one last weekend. And spring is this weekend, I think 4 a.m. Don't quote me, I'd have to look it up. Is the vernal equinox on Saturday when the sun's strongest rays, the direct rays of the sun, cross back over the equator into the northern hemisphere this weekend and will be with us the next 6 months. So things are looking up. And yeah, near 60 both Saturday and Sunday. Lots of sunshine tomorrow and Saturday again, just like today, abundant sun. There'll be some high clouds Sunday that'll kind of filter out. And then next week looks soggy. Monday night into Tuesday night, early Wednesday, we've got a big classic spring storm system winding up. And we're going to be don't put away the shovels or anything just yet. We're watching very closely. Once again, a very narrow area of snow. This time it's going to be rain to start for sure, almost certainly. Though we could see if the timing is right, you know, this time of year, it's easier to get snow on if you're in a warm side of a storm like this to get snow at night when it's colder. But Tuesday night, we're going to have to watch the possibility of a narrow area of snow. The models all pretty much agree that western and northwestern Minnesota, the strongest likelihood of that. But we're right on the edge. The European model has us on the edge of at least a couple of slushy inches Tuesday night, and then not far to the west of us. could be over a half foot for some spots. So we're going to have to watch that really closely. Obviously, it's Thursday. We got several days to go yet.
Mm-hmm. Go watch it. It's up on social media. I got it on the Facebook and the Twitter page. Go to YouTube. Follow Sven Sundgaard there. Bringmethenews.com as well. Sven, thank you very much. I appreciate the time as always.
You bet. I'll have a weather update tomorrow, looking at that storm next week and talking about some record warmth in Iceland above the Arctic Circle. They're warmer than we've been at all so far this spring.
That doesn't seem to be broken at all. Then
no, everything's fine.
Everything's fine. Sven Sundgaard, kind enough to join us on a Thursday. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. On a serious note, to end out the show today here, I want to talk a little bit about the, you know, once again, it is just infuriating to see the people trying to treat the tragedy that happened down in Atlanta as something that, oh, how can you say race is involved? Eight people in the three spots, six of whom were Asian women. Clearly, Asian and women were part of this man's, his agenda. Clearly it was. And it wasn't, like I said yesterday, where he went from one, like a gas station right next door to a cleaner's, right next door to a trophy shop, right next door to a bakery. No, he went from one place across town. It sounds like he was heading to Florida to talk to target someone else. He was targeting Asian women. And the fact that, you know, you have this police officer who's out there saying, well, he had a really bad day. And then you find out he has been posting racist memes. I did see the story today of the elderly Asian woman. I think she was 71 years old. It was San Francisco. Some guy just came up in the street and punched her, and she dropped him like a puck. My God. I mean, she was sitting there. Now, she was injured. She obviously got injured. But the guy was being taken away on a stretcher, for God's sakes. Nicely done. The Stop AAPI Hate Reporting Center has documented nearly 3,800 self-reported cases of anti-Asian bias over the last year, including 42 here in Minnesota. About 7% of COVID-19-related calls made to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights since April allege anti-Asian bias and discrimination. A spokeswoman said, for context, about 5.3% of the state's population identifies as Asian or Pacific Islander. Advocates say the figures might not capture the full scope of the problem, given fear that some may have been reported incidents to authorities. What they're saying is community and political leaders across Minnesota condemn the attack and the broader increase of racism. Racist language and attacks on the Asian Americans have skyrocketed as a result of COVID-19 misinformation and racial epithets spouted by our previous president, six legislators in the Minnesota Asian Pacific Caucus said in a joint statement. We experience hate in many forms every day, leaving us with the fear of, will our community be next? Lan Trang, communications director for the St. Paul-based Asian American Organization Project, echoed these sentiments, saying the group is seeing reactions and of horror and sadness in our community, but not surprise. Minnesota GOP chair Jennifer Carnahan, who has spoken about her own experience with discrimination, said violence based on race is despicable, must be broadly condemned. St. Paul Police Department said, while it's not aware of any new or specific threats, the chief has reached out to leaders in our Asian community to listen to concerns and offer support. Nancy Yang, a digital producer and national board representative for the Asian American Journalists Association, shared a powerful and raw call to action on Twitter. I'm sad. I'm tired. I'm heartbroken. I don't know what else to say. For goodness sakes, you know, yes, once again, Trump. Once again, Trump and his supporters. Once again, you know, the well of racism spews forth. For goodness sakes, stop it. Stop it. Just please. Native Roots Radio up next. Well, till tomorrow. See ya.